So I thought that the millennium had come, that forever after we would all trash. Yes, the end of the world is when all trash is Mazari Sharif hash. When trash becomes hash. But at the crack of dawn the next morning, I went tearing down to my harshest critic and knelt beside her hammock and woke her up and said, you know, you've got to smoke this. And of course, you know, garbage was back. So I don't know why I got off into this. I guess it was the life is art thing, and this thing about what would you do if you could do anything.
You should just enhance that little story with the myth. Isn't it from New Guinea about the good ship? Do you remember that one where they generated...
You mean the thing about the resin? Where the resin bar grew longer?
Yes, and this is
true. I'm not sure how this relates to it, but I'll tell it. In the study of messianic movements, in fact, you can read about this in Sylvia Thrupp's book, Millennial Dreams in Action, where she talks about a number of millennial religious groups. There was a movement around 1910 in Java called the Kalupan movement. And it was some guy was sitting on his porch one day in a hut off in the jungle, and he was playing his flute. And they collect copal in the forest there and sell to traders. And as he was playing his flute, he noticed that this bar of rolled out copal multiplied to twice its size right in front of him. And not only did this happen, but at the same moment it happened, his mind was flooded with the sudden realization that the meaning of this event was that all human lives were now going to be twice as long as they had previously been before. And he started, he told people in his village, and he had the proof because they had this bar of copal that was twice as long than anybody ever rolled them in that village. So it spread from village to village. And before long, people from all over Java were vectoring in on this place. And eventually the army had to be sent to put up roadblocks and turn people back. And it all had to do with this piece of resin, which had doubled in length while this guy was playing his flute.
And that is what's called a cognitive hallucination.
A cognitive hallucination.
Right, where an idea becomes so real to you that you see it, but then there's this funny border where maybe it becomes so real that other people see it, and maybe that's actually how we keep enlarging and complicating reality, is by having consensual
like
cognitive hallucinations of
what's
possible.
That's right.
Yeah.
The ayahuascaro that Kat mentioned that we like so much and worked with in Peru, Don Fidel, he lived off this road when we knew him, a few miles down this trail. And we would go over there often and walk with him back and forth between his house and where we could catch these little jitney buses into town. And he said one afternoon as we were walking along through the Amazon jungle, apropos of nothing, he said, "This is the path that Christ walked when he lived on earth." And it became so. You saw that somehow this was not a logical statement. This was a statement about the transposition of time and dimensionality, and that he was living in the light of Christ, that he was living in the presence of the Master through being enveloped in a cognitive hallucination. And I think our entire culture is headed for being enveloped in a cognitive hallucination where our real wishes will be fulfilled. And that's why it's so important to find out what our real wishes are. One of the most powerful forms of yoga, one of the highest yogas, is what's called the Anuttara Yoga Tantra. And it involves a series of visualizations. And they say, imagine your home as a splendid palace. And imagine the common utensils of your everyday life as golden vessels, vessels of beaten gold encrusted with jewels. Imagine your raiment as being made of the finest silk. And imagine yourself as a god centered in the midst of all of this splendor. Well, this is like trying to induce what in Western psychotherapy is called a delusion of grandeur. A delusion of grandeur is when you're a hell of a lot happier than other people think you should be, you know? And you say, what do you have to be so happy about? And it's all about infusing the quality of life with greater purity. We were saying around the fire last night that the way to relate to the millennium is to make it happen as soon as possible in your life so that you become a spectator to it as a historical phenomenon. Well, the way to make it happen in your life is to not transcend desire, but transmute it so that what you really want is what you actually have, you know.
I find on these plants, on the mushroom particularly, I found it effective to will, to choose to become an archetype that I both, of course, have to be able to identify as an archetype, but then also one that I can relate to and wish to be and become, you know, as large, 100, 1,000 times larger than we are, and as smooth and as everything is right, you know. You can practice being in the Tao so deeply in those states and knowing that everything you do, no matter how minuscule it is, you're doing most gracefully, and everything you say, you're saying most eloquently. And, you know, even I've used the mending sock thing because sometimes I feel like that's what I'm doing, is that level of work, but then I'm doing it perfectly, you know, and that's a great feeling. If you indulge in that feeling of being the goddess or a god or goddess or one of whatever you identify with, you know, one of the Kachinas, whatever, then you can carry it back. It's a really good way to carry it back into your daily life and learn to practice it, either in moments when you're wobbly and you suddenly need to grow into the situation, or in moments of ecstasy, you know. I mean, to be archetypes making love is pretty good.
Well, that's the technique of tantric practice, of imagining these gods in union with their consorts, in sexual union.
Can we have a break?
Yeah, let's have a break.
Hey. of our birth, blessed be today. Singing, hey, hey, what can I say? Blessed be. Shed to cease, blessed be today. Sending a prayer for a future of peace, blessed be.
The people burning to speak should speak.
I have maybe one comment that in different parts I keep hearing people saying that we don't know anything, but I think we're all dancing around it very well, and I think you're dancing around it really well. And so I think we do know something, not a lot perhaps, but we do know something. If words are that important and do have that meaning, whether it's what we're saying that is true, or just the sound of our voice that is true, something is true. We're here. Beginning to say the unsayable. I just have that feeling.
And what a feeling it is. Yes, well, we feel the dizziness of the things not said. We feel it. We're dizzy from it. It's here.
Attach themselves to this larger structure and keep getting larger and larger. Pieces fall off. People add. But just trust is that leap of faith to the other side of what you can't see, what you can't understand. But to trust it as you trust your lover, as you trust a friend. And it doesn't always work out, but trust is the only way. Because otherwise, there is only fear. Fear of ourselves, fear of others, fear of ideas. I think this community is part of that, of building trust among people who have different ideas.
I'd like to say something about learning and teaching with regard to the psychedelic experience. That you can use a lot of verbiage in trying to explain to people what that search is about and what that adventure will yield. But in the end, probably the best communication is to just dispense the sacrament. And I think it's very holy work, and I just want to express my appreciation to those who are involved in that work with great respect for the sacrament and for those to whom they dispense it. And I'm just very happy to be associated with you folks. Mm-hmm. I think that's something I've missed for a long time, since the days of the 60s. It was the last time I was around people who knew about that work and approached it with the kind of reverence that I see here.
The great thing about the psychedelics is that they speak for themselves. So they need no priest, no interpreter. They can deliver their message all by themselves.
Something that happened after that song seemed to be so wonderful, with words, maybe the unspeakable is being together in a room in silence. I just feel complete today. It's like nothing else to say. For me, who's always babbling, it's quite an event.
Well, it's wonderful to feel so comfortable with people that you don't have to rattle on.
Yes.
Why don't you lead us now, Kat, in a meditation?
Hold hands.
Can you hold hands?
We've seen many eggs in the last 2 days and had the pleasure of holding them and swallowing them and spoken of luminous eggs, and it seems just to be very eggy today, right? Resurrection and all that stuff. So I was thinking that our luminous eggs should meet each other in maybe a less verbal way. If we close our eyes, and find your center, the light, and let it swell out into your egg, your shape. And then you feel that light of yourself moving into your head and letting everything else out of it. You can breathe through the top of your head and through your forehead and your eyes and let it become, let your head become like a cloud of light. When it's that strong, that floats up above your head till you have a sphere of light that you can feel and see just above the top of your head. It seems to get more and more charged as you perceive it. And then it grows. The light is growing, the sphere is growing rounder and fuller and softer until it meets the lights of your neighbors. And we have a huge halo over us together. If you travel through it in your light, you'll encounter everyone very softly. And we can charge that halo of light to be stronger and bigger than us. I feel like it becomes a sphere, a dome above and beneath us, which meets the light of the spirit of this place, the spirit that lives here. It's partly in the earth and partly in the air. And very old and wise, with a sense of humor. And so we're all inside our collective luminous egg, which we could take anywhere, actually. But perhaps for now we should just greet the spirit of this place and gradually breathe and draw the white light energy back into ourselves, into our circle. And into our individual spaces above and through and beneath us. And when we go out and sit on the rocks alone, we can keep doing this. Even though we're not in a circle. good to connect with all of you. Thank you.
Let me think of how to phrase this best. You were suggesting that this kind of visual language somehow, our future lies there somehow, and I know that Jose Arguelles talks about the future technology being light and sound in probably the same way that you're talking about it. I guess my interest in formulating this question has to do with things like the Mayan hieroglyphic language system, or also Egyptian hieroglyphs, or basically that kind of visual language system. I also think of Northwest Coast Indian designs, where there's very particular kind of design patterns. And another piece of this question is the interface between the past use of that and the future use of that somehow. That it seems that, I mean, my sense of these hieroglyphic languages is that in the past they would literally see these things that are being drawn, or these things would speak to them or provide information as you're talking about. And that somehow, as we've evolved, we've lost that ability somehow, or buried it, or shunted it off to one side. And so my question has to do with, is there some sense of the re-emergence, or the, in the Joyce sense, here comes everybody, the democratization of that ability in future culture?
Yes, well, I think so. I think that the way these hieroglyphic languages, especially Mayan and Egyptian, differ from alphabetic languages is that etymology remains on the surface in a hieroglyphic language, so that thousands of meanings are immediately visibly present. And so it's more like an ideogram rather than a word with a dictionary meaning. You couldn't really, I doubt that a Mayan could conceive of a dictionary of Mayan glyphs, because they infinitely shade off one into another. So that, and that kind of sensitivity to the depth of language and to the presence of the past in the present, in a word, is what Joyce is trying to do in Finnegan's Wake, you know. And that's why, if you read it carefully, you feel many historical layers of meaning in the same passage, because he wrote it with almost a pictographic consciousness of the meaning of the words rather than a lineal and literary sense of it. So, yes, it's in that sense, it's like that. How this will be achieved in the future in our culture, I'm not sure. The control of the Macintosh through an internationally set of internationally understood set of control glyphs is very weird. And if any of you have worked with a Macintosh, you immediately see, this idea which seems very odd could, in fact, I could learn this very quickly and anyone can do it, kind of thing. Maybe presages a world of illiterate computer users who communicate with computers through symbols, because literacy has been lost. But it's very interesting. Yeah.
So you see, computers might play a role in that kind of visual component. Actually, I've heard you talk about, actually, Bruce, when you asked your question about will computers become intelligent life, I've heard you talk about it more that the technology of computers will become available to us as almost a biological extension of who we are.
Yes, that's what I think will happen. That, I mean, my vision of a perfect world is where, you know, the earth is restored to its prehistoric Edenic perfection, but technology has not been eliminated. It's merely been micro-miniaturized to the point where the computers which maintain the history of the race and the governance of the planet have all been secreted in a certain pebble which lies on a certain beach somewhere on the planet, and we walk around in perfect harmony with nature and in perfect and complete touch with an imaginary holographic world that is our self-expression, as a city is our self-expression, to then be simultaneously, you know, in the world of techne and in the world of nature, but with neither violating the other. And I think that's reasonable. In fact, I think perhaps, in a sense, this is what so-called preliterate cultures in the Amazon and places have achieved. That's how it looks to them from the inside. They have an extremely rich inner life. It isn't maintained by vast computer networks and projected into holographic space and taped onto magnetic tape and all of that, but it's still, in feeling, it's the notion that the richest world is within, and that you promote a balance with the exterior world, but then the purpose of the leisure created when you have achieved balance is not then to accumulate things, but to explore the interior horizon of transcendence through the recitation of myth and ecstasis and this sort of thing.
Terence, in connection with Robert's question, conjunction with it, could you further elaborate this idea of the material externalization of the soul and the internalization of the body as a definitive thing in evolution?
Well, I think imagination is where we want to go, that this has become the arrow of our epigenetic development, because everybody says, in the future, you'll have everything you want. Well, if we believe this, then we have to think seriously about what everything you want is. I mean, obviously, you want plenty of food, plenty of clothes, plenty of money, plenty of friends. But then if you get all that, and then they say, well, you haven't even dented your credit account. Well, then it says, well, I want to live at Versailles, surrounded by brilliant robots and I want great writers and artists to have lunch with me every day, and the Hope Diamond and Rembrandts. And eventually this becomes very silly, and instead there is an ascent toward truly grandiose aspirations, you know, truly a bodhisattvic calling. And I think that the imagination is the real frontier. This is why the poets and the artists are so important. And this is why I think one of the aspects of the space thing that is never mentioned by the L5 Society or any of these engineering types who are so into it is the interesting thing about outer space. We are not going to go through space to other worlds. That will be very incidental to going into space. Going into space means going into space, that space itself is a medium with unique properties for a species such as ourselves. And one of those unique properties is that engineering, which on the surface of the planet has to always be cognizant of stress and bearing loads and the limitation of materials, engineering is just going to become like ballet. And objects miles in extent can be created that are obedient only to the laws of the human imagination. And of course, the funding available to create these things. But in other words, the constraints of nature are pretty much lifted. Outer space is very much like what you see when you close your eyes in a dark room. It's a vast, unfilled void into which anything whatsoever can be projected. The hallucinations of the individual are the cultural artifacts of the species 500 years from now. I mean, all these visions and dreams that we have will be realized. I mean, in ways that we cannot imagine, but realized nevertheless. This has been consistently what has been going on. The alchemical dreams of the 16th century are fully realized in the 20th century, you know. And of course it has facets that they never imagined. But going into space and going into the imagination is the same thing. And in the same way that the New World presented a tremendously tight genetic filter to immigrants, so that only the soldiers of fortune, the religious fanatics, and exiles came to this place, and that created a unique gene mix. Space is going to be a much tighter genetic filter. I mean, most people who go are going to be very smart and very healthy, very quickly, I think, a space type will arise. But I don't think you can create a space-based civilization without recourse to psychedelic plants and the psychedelic experience, because it's too much the same thing. You know, if you don't integrate psychedelics into the leap to space and realize that what is happening is that more and more we perfect the aspiration to vertical ascent. In the myth of Icarus and Daedalus, you get this. Then in the brothers Montgolfier and their gas-filled balloon, and then the Wright brothers, and then the Apollo project. All of these things are, you know, this aspiration to ascension. And it is apparently a biological drive. I mean, some people have suggested it's a nostalgia for the canopies of the rainforests that no longer exist. But whatever it is, it's going to take us eventually out to the stars and inward to the stars. Because, you know, the real question mark which hangs over all this is the nature of mind. And we do not know what mind is. And yet everything goes on upon the stage that is conditioned by and assumes mind as a given. And every society has assumed that it had the answers, that just 15 years more of fine-tuning of the current ideology would do it. And no society has ever been right about that. So why should we be right? We are hurtling toward an unimaginable future in the same way that our present would have been unimaginable to people 200 or 500 years ago. But it is the imagination, because it is consciousness that is growing and expanding and strengthening itself. And if we take the notion that these psychedelic plants are consciousness-expanding agents, this is what they were originally called, consciousness-expanding drugs, if you take that seriously for a moment, how can you not center it in your life? I mean, obviously, consciousness is what must be expanded as fast as possible, at all costs, in all times and places, because it is a lack of consciousness that will be toxic to our species and the planet. Consciousness is the saving grace, and so it has to be cultivated by any means available. Yeah.
You're saying that this urge to go into space is something like a biological urge, and also maybe something relating to the rainforest. And
well, I think we're like the trigger species.
Yeah. Well, the point I want to make is that, you know, when we think of going to space, we're so human-centered, and it's like, yes, us as humans can exist in space and exist there, but I think what's really important about going away from this planet's surface is it's not just a human-centered thing, it's a totally biological thing, and that we are just the implements of it. We are the thinking, conscious, creative tool-makers that will be able to implement this, getting off of this gravity trap, this gravity well, but it's not just for humans, it's for all life, and we have to, it'll be a complete synthesis
of
all biological life that will exist away from the planet.
If we go to space, we will take everybody with us.
Just like in a rainforest, it's not just... It's everything. It's
that's right. We are the species that is deputized to use energy to do the thing for all life on the planet. That's why I'm not pessimistic about history, and I don't see history as unnatural or somehow opposed to nature. What history is a 10,000-year process by which the monkeys attain enough understanding of physical processes to build the habitats into which all life on the planet can then migrate. That's what I was talking about this morning when I said I think the planet senses the finite of its, the finiteness of its existence, and that biology is a wild scheme for getting out to the stars for dispersal of life. And you're right. No, we, though we have great hubris and believe we are doing this and man will go to the stars, it's more that man is the pecking beak of the cosmic egg, of the cosmic chick in the egg of life on Earth. And the entire bird will emerge and fly, but it was man with his atomic weapons and his radar and all this who can break the shell, and then the whole of the biosphere will flow outward into space and escape the cycle of energy degradation that will eventually turn this solar system into a group of cold cinders rotating around a red giant or a something. What? Yes, well, we're trying to compare our maps. Everybody has seen different pieces of a geography whose total size we don't know. So we don't know, maybe none of our maps overlap, or maybe some do and some don't. And maps which don't overlap are not invalidated. It just means nobody has been there but you. I mean, I often have the feeling that I'm seeing things that no one has ever seen before. Often.